Okay, so good afternoon, everybody. So I will talk a bit about GNU-Herd, indeed, the latest progress from various people, actually. A few people have joined the Joyce recently. I would like to make just a quick recap on the purpose of the Herd and some things that have been available for a long time already. That's my opinion. The Herd is all about freedom zero, that is, freedom zero in free software is the freedom to run the program for all purpose. And for me, that includes the freedom from the sysadmin of the machine. That is why all these programs hidden in /sbin should be able to partition an image. There's no reason not to be able to do it and make it and mount it. And mounting on Linux is a privileged operation. It shouldn't be a privileged operation. I should be able to mount an image, take something out of it, and everything. The idea is that I have access to some part of the disk. I have access to the network. I want to be able to do anything with that. And that's also the freedom to innovate. That is, if you want to experiment with a file system, you should be able to do this without having to insert a module into a kernel or whatever. Or maybe you have a personal workflow that matches some use case and not the ones that were configured. And maybe you have a PCI card in a machine and you want to give it to a user and do whatever he wants to do with it. But conversely, you want to have some freedom from misbehaving programs. So for the administrator, get free of the bugs introduced by the users, but also the admin get rid of the bugs of the drivers and everything. So that's why we want to isolate things. So that's what it looks like on GNU-Herd. So we have the microkernel here, and basically the goal is just manage the task memory, IPC, and then everything else is in user land. So here we have like proc, who knows about processes, PFINet, the TCP/IP stack, X2FS for the file system, auth, who knows about who is who, and then we have actual programs, a shell and copying. And what happens is the shell is actually, when it opens a file, it asks X2FS, and X2FS asks auth, but who is that guy who is opening a file, what authorizations does it have? Which means that when a server crashes, it's not a problem. You get an error. You don't get a blue screen of something or whatever. You just get errors. And it's also easier to tune and to debug. You can attach to X2FS and then put breakpoints into your file systems. And then since it's easier to develop, then you can do crazy things. In that the Herd console, text consoles can actually print all kinds of fonts, including Chinese and everything, because it loads glyphs on the fly, because it's easy to do without the kernel way of developing things and just user land things. And we can virtualize at very fine grain. We had talks about it previously at FOSDEM. Just to give an example, so here I have the TCP/IP stack, and I'm stacking on it an FTP translator to access files and transparently through FTP. Then I have an ISO file system translator who knows about ISO images, and then I can run a shell that opens a file in it. So to show how it looks like, so here I'm putting a translator on my home, which is called FTP colon, which is a multiplexer over the host name for the FTP translator. And so I do it just once for the whole installation of my system. And then when I want to mount an ISO image, I just tell, okay, take this ISO image. So it's inside that mount point. So we access that FTP server, and then we get an ISO image. And we mount this through the ISO translator on MNT. And then when we can look at it, and we have the files. We can even extract things. We can mount an X2 image inside the ISO image and take things from there. Everything is possible. And that's possibly stored in the file system. That is, this is stored for good, even after rebooting. And things which are found like a signature file which changes every time you open it. It actually runs a new instance of Fortune, so you get a new content every time you open it. So yeah, that's fun. So the status, it's quite stable. I've never really reinstalled the box really from scratch. Sometimes it crashes and we fix with X2FS, but having to reinstall, I've not done it for a decade at least. While we have the build daemons in Debian, which keep building packets all the time, and that goes fine. We have 3/4 of the Debian archive, which works fine. But at least it builds. We haven't tested every of them. But nowadays, there's a lot of test suites in the past, in the packages. So at build time of the package, we actually test the package. So yeah, it works really well. And we have support merged upstream in GCC, glibc, etc. And recently we had a Gix released, which had a hurt part of it. So that's great. So okay, what's the point of today? That's the newest things. So first, the really hardware part. So I did PAE for 32-bit machines, which became really a necessity when trying to build WebKit to GTK, for instance, because it really requires a lot of memory. So if you have a 32-bit operating system, you have to implement PAE just for this. Otherwise, yeah, you're quite screwed. So we added support for APIC and HPAT. HPAT also is really required nowadays. Software really assumed to have a high precision and timing. Usually in operating systems, you just advance time on clock tick, on interrupts, but that's really not enough for nowadays software. So we've seen like in PostgreSQL, we had a test suite which was surprised that time doesn't advance that much, just only every clock. So yeah, we implemented it. So we have ACPI and PCI driving essentially in user space. So for ACPI, we just pick up libACPI CA and we run it in user land. And whatever the result of the interpreter, we tell the kernel, OK, this interrupt, we want to configure it this way. And the PCI arbiter is also a bit of the same. So we have libPCI access, which has an x86 driver. Well, we just run it in user land, and then we can let applications use that. Continued on this, so we have USB support for disk and CD, which is essentially using RAMP USB disk. So it's the continuation of what we had for SATA disks, and just taking the RAMP. So it's actually BSD drivers compiled for user land. And so we just take that. So we have two processes, one for USB disks and one for SATA disks. So for now, it embeds the USB stack. So we have the disk driver and the USB stacks in the same process for simplicity. But we plan to split that into a USB driving process, which we can use for different USB drivers, and then have the disk USB driver on top of it. So for network device, we are planning to use RoomNet. We have something working already for one driver for now. Previously, we were using a NetDD. So that was 2.6 at the time. We didn't spend the time to upgrade that because the net layer in Linux is advancing so much. So we prefer to keep on with the BSD source, which is much easier to work with. So the idea is that for hardware support, we are basically assuming the maintenance of the RAMP layer on top of BSD. I believe that's a long-term good decision in that the BSD development is less crazy than Linux. So yeah, maintaining RAMP, at least in the past several years, maybe a decade, maybe, we haven't seen too much work to do to keep up with the pace. So this is how it looks like nowadays. So we have the kernel, which is really doing just task memory and IPC. And then we run ACPIC in its own process, libpcixs in its own process, and then Rube and SATA in their own process. And X2 accesses the disk through SATA ROM, for instance. SATA just asks PCIXS and ACPA for some configuration, but otherwise it just accesses the disk directly. And I forgot to write, the kernel raises interrupt to the SATA ROM to tell it the operation has terminated. Okay, so more on the software part. So we have 64-bit support, which is finished. It's running really well nowadays. There was some work previously, but the latest pieces that were missing, so there was just the x86 boot. Who has really implemented x86 booting in the room? Almost nobody, yeah, just a few hands. How awful do you see it? You start in 16-bit, then you move to 32, and then to 64 you have to put the page table. It's crazy. So yeah, that's why it took some time. Then we have the RPCs. So the herd is really with RPCs everywhere. So we had to teach the RPC engine about 64-bit. So basically fixing the translation, how you lay out the message, etc. But once we had done that, then all system calls are actually ported. In that we just fixed MIC, maybe a couple of bugs here and there, and then we had all the interfaces of files and directories, network, etc., ported to 64-bit. We don't have that kind of complex compatibility, 32-bit, 64-bit, that like there is in Linux. So it went quite easily. We had some work, but we weren't worried that some special corners would be difficult. For GCC and JDB, mostly it was plumbing because there is already x86 64 support there, of course. And then for the herd part itself, so the translators of everything, there were fixes about 64-bitness, so not confusing long ints and everything. But otherwise, all the software layers were just fine. And the thing is, now that we have fixed the bitness, we know that for ARM64, RISC-V 64, etc., we won't have to do anything more than this. So it will work fine. So then the question is, how do you get an actual operating system? I mean the packages you install and everything. So bootstrapping the software. So I did it for Debian. The essential part was the software there is more and more cross-buildable, and that's really great because then you can actually bootstrap an operating system, a complete operating system, through cross-compilation. So what happened is that first we were using a script from Flavio that just uses configure make install with target and host options to cross-compile GCC, glibc, etc., just to get something that works. You get a shell and it does say something, okay. And then we know that, okay, it seems to be working fine. Then we want an actual distribution. And in Debian, we have the rebootstrap script, which is basically cross-building all the base packages of Debian. So with that, we had all the necessary packages to actually install a build daemon. So I installed that into an actual herd system. And then I just let it build all the rest of Debian. Some packages do not produce the same when cross-compiling like this and then compiling natively. So we build all the packages and just to be sure. We know just a few cases where there are runtime tests that are done by configure. So you really want to recompile once you have an actual native system. It made the delay for Debian 2025, which was released last year. So we have a release of herd 64-bit. And we have some preliminary work for ARM64, which might come if we spend enough time on it. So we have SMP support quite recently. MAH, which we based the herd on, originally had SMP support. It was really a research kernel, actually, at the time. So there was already the framework there for logs, scheduling, and everything. So we knew, okay, everything like that is okay. But then there's x86 support, which was completely missing for SMP. So Anmut and I worked on it. So basically detecting that you have indeed several CPUs, enumerate them, and then startup. And the startup is again crazy, even crazier. You really start again in 16-bit, then 32. It's crazy. But yeah, they fixed it. Damien fixed a lot of things and also ported to 64. But now it does work, it does boot. For now, we are quite cautious in that all the userland translators that we have, for now, we just execute them on CPU 0 so that they are not exposed to actual multiprocessor concurrency. But otherwise, all the other processes can go in other CPUs. So we get parallelism for the compiler, for instance, which is great for C++ and everything. And then once we have fixed the translators one by one, once we work on one and we put it on other CPUs, when we see it's stable, then okay, we can move to the other CPUs, and all the others we keep on one CPU, so we don't have a switch, a big switch like in monolithic kernels where it's either every driver is running on all CPUs or just on one. So we can do this progressively. Okay, so now really the software part. We had some security fixes. So there was a talk just a couple of hours before about capacities. So in GNUMA, it's called ports. And we have to take care of not leaking ports. There were some leaks, so Sergey fixed that. There were some memory issues also. Michael worked on it. And StressNG, I really recommend using it for your own operating system because it really stresses your own operating system. You have a bug that happens one every 1 million. It will put the nail on it. So yeah, really use that. It's useful. And the TCP/IP stack used to be an old Linux 2.2 stack. Again, it's really hard to follow the Linux pace. So what we plan to do, we have something working already. We don't have made the switch by default yet, but basically using LWIP, which is maintained. Well, why not? It's a library, so we can just use it and stuff into a process. About translators, we used to, so in slash dev and slash servers, we used to have records of slash dev, slash dty, slash dev, slash sda, etc. To have records which are extensions of the X2 format, which was properly defined, etc., but which Linux didn't know at all about. So we moved to using XHDRs that Linux does know, and which makes it possible to just install the herd completely from a Linux system with also all the extra things like translators, which is really great in that you can actually create your chroot and things like this cross installation wise, and that works. We have journaling support, which is in progress. It doesn't seem that hard, actually. It's just nobody took the time to do something. So we will have it quite soon, apparently. We have moved to just use XKB for the text console to avoid having to maintain the keyboard layouts. About software quality, so we have more and more continuous integration. So GNOME has now a make check target. The idea is that it starts QEMU and it loads a GNOME kernel and a small program that just tests some system calls so that we can test each piece of the kernel automatically. It was really, really, really nice to be able to do the 64-bit port, because then you don't have to start a whole shell or something complex like this. You start with just each and every system call of a microkernel, which is not that much, create a task, allocate memory, etc. But once you have these small pieces checked, then the user land goes fine. So it's now in CI. In Debian, we have CI as well, thanks to porting Go on the HUD. So we could compile the GitLab runner, and then we have a runner that is available for a Debian package. We also have animals for Xeam and PostgreSQL. Ideally, we would have integration of these CI into each and every upstream as much as possible. We have it in glibc, for instance, so that people stop breaking the compilation of glibc on GNU/HRD, and that's really helpful. Even if they don't actually test, at least it does compile, and usually it works fine. We have fixed some warnings, so I'm just praising Diego for taking the time to do it. Really, you want to avoid warnings at all costs because they are really helpful. It is a uphill battle against GCC because they introduce them all the time. Ideally, you test both GCC and LLVM, and whatever tool can give you warnings, really take them, fix them. There's one thing I wanted to mention also is pthread in libc. So traditionally, to get pthread functions, you have to link with minus l pthread. Glibc started moving all these symbols into libc itself, so you don't have to link with minus l pthread anymore. And so people nowadays have stopped using minus l pthread, so we had to make the move. If you want to port programs, etc., well, it will be easier to just move the pthread symbols into glibc, into your own libc. Okay, about language. So we did port the Rust. So is it Rust that gets ported on GNU/HRD, or the contrary? It was not clear for the maintainers of Rust. For me, it's really Rust that has to make some efforts, but okay. It was tedious. It was really tedious. Vedant took the time to do it. In Rust, you have to teach Rust all the ABI details, so each and every function of your libc, all your structures, etc., you have to teach it. You have a file where it's all described. There's BindGen that is able to generate such thing from your header, which is the natural way of doing it, but it's not done automatically. And so you have to take the output of BindGen, look at it, see that some pieces are wrong, that it's not the shape that upstream would like. So we had to review all of what BindGen generated, so the whole ABI of libc, basically. It took some time. The problem is that Rust moves really fast, so every 40 days you have a new release. And if you want to build release n plus 1, you have to have a release n, which means you have ported, it was 174, I think. And so we had 174 working, okay, but upstream was already 178. So we had to port our patch 74 to 75, 76, 77, 78. Oh, they have moved to 79 in between. Let's port to 79. No, we are up to date, so okay, we don't have to do that anymore. But yes, Rust is really a useful, extremely useful step, but it's quite hard. And we have seen all the ifdefs that we have got written of in the C language mostly. They have put it a lot in Rust, so you will have to put in a lot of crates, hash config my target OS is this, and so yes, it does have sigint. Yes, like all Unix systems, but yeah, you have to tell Rust about it. There are even two crates that knows about Erno, so you have to port both of them. So okay, it's a bit of a pain, but yes, in the end we have it, and yeah, it's actually essential nowadays just to get some basic libraries built. We have Go as well, so Swanton did this. We could reuse a lot of BSD code, so it went really much easier than Rust. There were some tweaking. There's one thing we had to fix, that was the stack split support. So when you have a signal, you switch to another stack just for the signal and back. It's still not enough for quite a few packages because it's GCC Go that we have ported. We would have to port Golang to have all Debian packages built. There's Java. We had some work a long time ago by Emilio. So we had to add support in the herd for this. So siginfo, dynamic linker origin support and things like this. So he did that a long time ago. Jeremy worked on porting OpenGTK some time ago. We have JCG that works inside the GCC, but we would like to have an actual OpenGTK. Again, you have that effect N plus one builds only with at least N, and we have six. Seven should be fine, and already I think it's 25. Okay, we'll see. About dissemination, we have quarters of the herd, which Joshua took the time to write, and it's really useful to tell people what's happening. When we forget to do it, people think that it's not moving, while it is actually moving. Okay, but it is moving. We have some of these. So GeeksHerd has appeared, so there's a blog post about it, working on actual ThinkPad. We have an Alpine distribution showing up, maybe, we will see. So basically what do we have? So to give a summary, so we have all of this, so 64-bit SATA USB support network drivers, and this is essentially all in userland. And the really good thing is that most of this we don't maintain. We don't maintain all these drivers because we defer that to BSD people, to ACPICA, and etc. And I think it's really useful to just rely on existing libraries rather than just re-implement everything. For partitioning, this partitioning, okay, just use libpartied, and you are fine with that. So we have a lot of Debian, we have Geeks, etc. And I didn't mention everything, but you can look at previous videos for the herd. We have a lot of stuff that is interesting with fine-grained control, virtualization, and etc. Just to show one thing I really like. So here I'm pinging some GNU.org, and here, because maybe the network driver gets stuck or whatever, I just kill the network driver, and then after some time it shows up again, and it works fine because TCP is resilient to this. The only thing that happened is here, the only thing that the kernel saw that a process stopped using an IRQ, and then there's a new one that uses the IRQ. That's the only thing that the kernel saw. And yes, this is what it looks like. Everything like this is just a process, so you can, well, if you kill a disk, that's more of a concern because you don't want X2FS to just continue with the new one. You want to run FSCK in between, but that's just a software step and to have. So to conclude, we have this. There's a lot of things that we can achieve. There's a contributing page where we have the ideas for moving forward. It just needs your help. So thanks for your attention. Yeah?
You mentioned problems with cross-compilation.
Yeah.
I guess the Gentoo has to actually serve basically the same problem, doesn't it?
Gentoo?
Gentoo.
Gentoo.
Because they are building essentially the whole image from scratch, and sometimes they do it in a kind of cross-compilation nature.
So
are you inspired there?
So to recap, so Gentoo maybe has the same kind of cross-compilation issues that we have. The one thing that we saw was it Perl or Bash? I think it was Bash. Which was measuring the size of pipes. And so, yes, it's using the actual operating system. And so if it cannot do this, then it puts a value, and unfortunately it was wrong, and then, yeah, it was actually making Perl lose characters due to this because it was filling buffers, etc. So, yes, this is the kind of things that we have seen. Quite often, programs which are not able to test things at runtime, they would keep a conservative value, and then they will go fine. Not optimized, but at least fine. So most often, we don't see that much of a trouble, a few details. That's why you want to really recompile everything. But mostly it works. other questions? Yes?
Maybe I've missed it, but what's the story about journaling file systems for the Herd?
Which file system?
Journaling.
Journaling. So basically, it's just an additional piece that is, we are still working on it. You have to put into your file system implementation some calls to write to the journal and delay other things. So it's just an addition to the X2FS implementation. That's mostly it. Or maybe I didn't understand the question.
Yeah. Is that being worked on journal?
It is getting worked on, yes. We are discussing it on the list right now.
So continue this question. If you use drivers from BSD, why not use file systems from BSD?
Yeah, why not using the file system from BSD? That's one of the to-do list items, indeed. Somebody wanted to implement a journaling file system. Okay, it's just a few hundred lines more, so yeah, why not? But indeed, we want to use RoomFS at some point. There's quite some plumbing that's much more involved than just a network card you send, you receive. You have a lot of operations. But yes, that's one of the ideas we have.
And another thing is, why not make all this runtime to be like compatible with Linux binaries? This way,
so
you won't need to port software.
So, in the interest of time, we have to wrap it up. Maybe you can take it outside.
Yeah, just to answer quickly, so why not make it Linux compatible, binary compatible? We can recompile free software, since it's free software. So yeah, just why not recompile it? And we have a longer answer.